the New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Hello again and welcome to the show. Coming up, we hear the latest in regards to the issue of fraud in the pork industry. Quite astounding case. We'll hear the details of that stretching across Queensland and New South Wales as well. And we'll also look at the issue of backpackers and National Farmers Federation alarmed by potential changes to backpacker visas, which make up half of the seasonal workforce used by farmers across the nation.
Concerned and I would say alarmed at the suggestion that numbers would be cut back without any really clear understanding of what that might mean for individual businesses, for regional economies, for the food security of the nation.
All that and a whole lot more coming up. You can always comment on any of the stories you hear on the program. 0467 922 684 is the number to text me here at the Country Hour. But first up, it's been nearly 2 weeks since the handing down of a New South Wales parliamentary report into modern slavery, which recommended the urgent introduction of labour hire licensing schemes. Pressures on the government, it's mounting, with industry groups, academics, community organisations and survivors co-signing a statement yesterday calling for a licensing scheme to be implemented by July 2027. The state's anti-slavery commissioner, James Cockayne, has been on the mid-north coast and told Fiona Poole so far there's been little action from the government in Macquarie Street.
I think, like all political calculations, there's a calculation going on in Macquarie Street about the costs of inaction versus the costs of action. And the view appears to have been taken to this point that the costs of action outweigh the costs of inaction, of not putting something in place. Now, you have 28 groups came out yesterday and said, actually, no, we need this right now. We need it in this parliamentary term. That includes Berries Australia, Australian Fresh Produce Alliance, Unions New South Wales, the peak body for unions across the state, St Vincent's de Paul, Salvation Army, many, many organisations. So you're absolutely right, Fee. There's broad, broad consensus that we need this now. It's a question of keeping that pressure up on government to ensure that there is actually a recognition that the costs of inaction, including to those workers who are still out there on some of these farms being exploited, that the costs of inaction need to be tackled right now.
The government has 90 days to respond to the modern slavery report. Correct. And that is one of the recommendations.
It is.
I mean, has anyone sort of given you a bit of a nudge saying, yeah, look, this is just, it will happen. It's just going to take a couple of weeks.
No, they have not. The government's position is that they're considering all options, including a possible code of practice under the Work Health and Safety Act. The statement that came out yesterday from these 28 organisations essentially said that won't be adequate, thank you very much, because it essentially waits until people have been harmed and then investigates that. That's the system we have in place at the moment, and we see how that's working. What people want, what these 28 organisations want, is a gatekeeper, as we have in Victoria and Queensland, a gatekeeper that says you can only come into the labour hire market and offer labour hire services if you check out. We have no checks right now, so we're continuing today to hold the door wide open to crooks and dodgy operators, not just here in Coffs Harbour, but anywhere in any part of New South Wales that relies on the labour hire industry. So that's construction in Western Sydney, it's aged care in Newcastle, it's cleaning in Wollongong, it's a range of industries across the state, but that message has not yet got through where it counts in Sydney.
You've been meeting with a lot of people in this last fortnight. Who do you think has the power to really make a difference right here? Who is it?
All of us. So we do need labour hire regulation. That's a state government decision. That's essential, but it's not the end of the story. It's not sufficient. So we all have the ability to make a difference now, but what we need is a pathway forward to make clear who's going to take what responsibility for sharing what kind of information. So, for example, I talk to local councils about what their existing inspection powers are to do with unapproved dwellings, sanitation, septic, all of those kinds of things. and how they're going to ensure that when they do those inspections, if they're seeing overcrowding, even if overcrowding is not part of their formal mandate, that information needs to get to the relevant regulator who is responsible for dealing with that. Lots of us have information. We see these people in our streets. The average listener listening today, their responsibility is basically just to be humane and to check that their fellow human being who's here to make a contribution to our society, to our economy, to our community, is not going without food for days or weeks on end, is not living homeless or in squalor, is not, as I heard just a few days ago, being forced to drink dam water and shower in dam water on a blueberry farm that likely has pesticide runoff. These are the kinds of conditions that people are living in this region right now. When we see people in the street, it's basically, in the first instance, just a question of asking them, are you doing okay? Are you free to come and go? Are you getting paid a minimum wage? Those very basic questions. And then if you have concerns for them, reach out to 1-800-FREEDOM, reach out to the relevant authorities and share your concerns. 1-800-FREEDOM is the confidential, and I stress confidential, support and assistance line that my team runs for precisely these kinds of situations.
As New South Wales Anti-Slavery Commissioner James Cockayne speaking there to Fiona Poole. You're listening to The Country Hour. It's 11 minutes past 12. Well, on a related topic, the National Farmers Federation is alarmed by potential changes to backpacker visas, which make up half of the seasonal workforce used by farmers across the nation. The federal government has slowed the processes of new working holiday visa applications while it develops its migration changes. Meanwhile, opposition leader Angus Taylor isn't guaranteeing working holiday visa holders will be exempt from the coalition's plans to cut migration, although he has acknowledged concerns from the Nationals about the need for skilled labour in agriculture. NFF horticulture spokesperson Richard Shannon says they want both sides of politics to consult them before they make any changes.
Concerned and I would say alarmed at the suggestion that numbers would be cut back without any really clear understanding of what that might mean for individual businesses, for regional economies, for the food security of the nation. The cost of fresh produce in supermarket aisles, there's been a recent comprehensive government report into the food supply chain and the workforce needs, which found that horticulture, we had about 25% of our seasonal workforce temporary migrants, and of that, about half are backpackers. They're essential to our industry and the food security of the nation.
So when Tony Burke, and you would have heard those comments there, saying, well, the palm scheme's way more important to agriculture, that's our preferred visa for agriculture, so backpacker visa won't make a huge difference. Like, what do you say to that in terms of the worth of the visa to agriculture?
Both programs are really important. We are not wanting to get into a position where we're reliant on one. Before COVID, about 80% of our workforce were backpackers. Obviously that went through a significant change as then Prime Minister Scott Morrison told backpackers to go home. We then became more reliant on palm. That created its own issues. Industry is sick of the back and forward and the lack of certainty. It's really undermined confidence across the industry. We need a stable, secure, reliable, predictable workforce in our industry, and that's going to be a mix moving forward of palm and backpackers. They are not substitutes. They fill different roles and purposes, both in a very practical sense on farm, but in terms of the sort of labour need they meet, backpackers are far more flexible. Palm workers arguably more productive. We need a mix.
And then I suppose you hear about a go slow and the timing now in August. Are you worried as we sort of get into a busier period of time, usually in the warmer months down south, there becomes a greater reliance on these visas and workers in an agriculture setting?
Every employer in horticulture is very nervous about this. It is the government attempting to control what is effectively a market, the labour market. It has imperfect information about how that works. They have very little insight into the labour market in horticulture and how it works. They're proposing to control it and manage it. At the moment, it's a demand-driven system. Where there are jobs in horticulture and regional Australia, that pulls backpackers out of metropolitan centres into the regions for that work. If there are no jobs, then the backpackers stop turning up. It's not perfect, but it's far better than the government trying to control the program and meddle with the numbers. You know, they need to be able to tell us what they're doing with the numbers. And at the moment, we're hearing about a go slow with no idea about what that actually means in terms of the numbers and the workforce that we'll have available to us as an industry, even at a national level, let alone local and regional levels.
It's still part of a cabinet process. So NFF being the farm lobby group based in Canberra, will you be bringing a few government members to try and make sure your point of view is put forward?
Yeah, absolutely. We're reaching out to the Minister's office. The NFF Horticulture Council will be writing later today to Minister Burke. And we have a delegation coming to Canberra in a couple of weeks' time. Hopefully it's not too late, but before then we'll be taking every step possible to implore government gives us due consideration and considers the risk to food security and also the upward pressure likely to come on the cost of fresh produce in supermarket aisles. Warwick, one thing I'll add to this. At the very start of the first Labor term of government, the Prime Minister made a lot about restoring trust in government. And I think the Prime Minister then diagnosed what we now see is a fracturing of support, particularly for major parties, right? And a large part of that is meant to provide transparency, particularly to those most affected by government changes. And here we've got a government making changes in the background, not being upfront with industry about what they're doing and the extent to which that might affect the industry. And we need to expect better of our government.
Executive Officer for Horticulture with the NFF, Richard Shannon, speaking there to Warwick Long.
Every community has stories worth sharing. ABC Your Say is your chance to join the conversation. Tell us what's on your mind. Visit abc.net.au/yoursay.
Well, the Australian Veterinary Association has joined forces with animal welfare groups calling for an end to mulesing in the sheep industry. Australia is the only country in the world which permits the on-farm surgical practice, which removes the skin from the lamb's backside to prevent sheep from fly strike. President of the Sheep Special Interest Group of the AVA, Dr. Peter Windsor, told Annie Brown the association's updated policy doesn't put a deadline on the phase-out.
We haven't got evidence of the time it would take. We know that it's achievable in stud flocks, but not commercial flocks, the time period, and that's going to be highly variable because breech blowfly strike is a very complex disease with many genetic environmental interactions and will be variable between flocks. So we've resisted putting a timeline on it.
I guess for a lot of farmers listening, the question is, you know, mulesing for some people is a must. They feel like they can't get away from that practice. So what would the alternatives be for sheep producers and wool producers when it comes to mulesing if it was completely phased out?
Well, the long-term solution is genetic improvement of the flock. We're removing wrinkles and creating a barrier breech area through genetic gain. But in the interim, of course, there are many management tools that farmers use to decrease the fly strike risk other than mulesing. Mulesing is the most effective of the integrated pest management tools, but also use of chemical to decrease fly strike, reduce DAG scores, which attract flies, and also you can do that also through more crutching, and also adjusting the shearing times to have less wool on the sheep at the time when the flies are present.
In Australia, there are a few rules already in place when it comes to mulesing. Currently, the Australian Animal Welfare Standards and Guidelines require that sheep must not be mulesed if they are less than 24 hours old or older than 12 months. In Victoria, Tasmania and New South Wales, it is now mandatory to use some form of pain relief for mulesing at any age. Phasing out mulesing is not a new idea. In 2004, Australian Wool Innovation pledged to phase out the practice by 2010. However, the industry abandoned this deadline in 2009. Jo Hall is the chief executive of Wool Producers Australia. She says having a deadline in 2010 didn't work, and it wouldn't work today either.
I guess at the time, industry thought that it was a way of demonstrating leadership and responding to market concerns. But what I guess was learnt was that setting a date is one thing, but achieving it across Australia's diverse production systems is another. I mean, you've got to remember that merinos are raised in semi-arid areas through to, you know, our small alpine areas in Australia. So what might work in one area isn't going to work in another. So I think what we took away from that it's really important to ensure that industry commitments are underpinned by science and practical solutions and keeping animal welfare outcomes in mind. So I think we also learnt that, you know, transitioning away from mulesing is a long-term process, and it's going to involve genetic change, which can take many years across a lot of merino bloodlines.
What is the industry doing to decrease the amount of mulesing, and, you know, is that a priority?
So I think if you look at figures around offering of non-mules wool from the AWEX National Wool Declaration rates, this year, the 25-26 year, we see that just over 25% of wool sold at auction is declared non-mules. And then if you look at about 3.5% is declared as cease mulesing, and then nearly 46% is declared of mules with pain relief. So when you consider those three different categories on their own, you can see that industry has made major progress, with the vast majority of growers either not mulesing or ceasing mulesing or using pain relief.
You know, what is the incentive for farmers to transition away from mulesing?
So the biggest driver of practice change is financial, market-driven.
Yes, Jo Hall is Chief Executive of the Wool Producers Australia, and she was speaking there to Andy Brown and talking about the situation with the Australian Veterinary Association joining forces with animal welfare groups calling for an end to mulesing in the sheep industry, but no time frame there as yet. It's 22 minutes past 12.
You're with Michael Condon for the New South Wales Country Hour on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Well, four people connected with the pork meat industry have been charged over alleged large-scale financial crimes, which saw tens of millions of dollars funnelled out of businesses for personal use. The charges follow a joint investigation in New South Wales and Queensland. Kelly Buchanan has been following the story. Kelly, what do we know about this case?
The individuals are two from Queensland and two from New South Wales, and they're all business owners or representatives of the pork meat industry. Now, it's alleged that they kept $10 million in sales off the books for personal use, and that they moved more than $30 million in cash between the two states in freight vehicles between 2017 and 2026. Now, the two individuals from Queensland have been accused also of fraudulently relabeling frozen meat products to alter the production and best before dates, although authorities have confirmed that that practice has not posed any risk to food safety. And more than $25 million worth of assets, including $3 million in cash and two motor vehicles, have been seized as suspected proceeds of these alleged crimes.
Wow, that's an interesting case. What charges have been laid?
Well, the Queenslanders have been charged with offences including fraud, destroying records, receiving tainted property and making false declarations. And they'll both appear in the Brisbane Magistrates Court on the 14th of September. The two individuals from New South Wales are facing charges related to the destruction of records with the intent to defraud. And these charges follow a joint investigation that involved the Queensland Crime and Corruption Commission, the New South Wales Police Anti-Money Laundering Unit, and the New South Wales Crime Commission. And those authorities say it was a complex cross-border case and operation to unravel these financial crimes.
So what's the pork industry saying?
Well, the pork industry is not saying much. In a statement, Australian Pork Limited said it was aware of the media reports on the matter and that all businesses must follow the law, but it would not comment any further while the matter was before the courts. And we've reached out to several pork operations in Queensland today. Most are not commenting. Of course, Queensland accounts for about a quarter of the pork production in the country, so it is a significant industry in this state.
Kelly, thanks for that.
Thank you, Michael.
And still on that case, it's alleged that the four individuals connected with the pork meat industry kept $10 million in sales off the books for personal use and moved more than $30 million in cash between 2017 and 2026 between the two states of New South Wales and Queensland. There's also allegations of fraud, destroying records, receiving tainted property, making false declarations, as well as fraudulently relabeling frozen meat products to alter production and best before dates as well, apparently not affecting human health as a result, according to the authorities. Professor Andreas Chai is the director of the Academy of Financial Crime Investigation and Compliance at Griffith University, and he explained to Megan Hughes how these sorts of crimes happen.
They need to move the money in a way that is not suspicious and is efficient. One common approach has been trade-based money laundering. So that involves either over-invoicing or under-invoicing for goods. In this case, it looks like it's pork meat. And it looks like that, the money that's been sent from one state to the other is substantially more than the actual value. So what would happen is they might inflate the invoice by quite a substantial portion and then send that money over. And so the basic idea is that when a bank or, an accountant or a lawyer might ask, where's this money coming from? They have paperwork that kind of says, oh, this is related to trade of pork meat. The movement of pork across borders when in fact it is actually dirty money.
They've sort of made it, I guess, it seems legitimate rather
Correct.
Than, yeah.
So you're hiding the true sort of origins of money. So a lot of people might note that, when you're moving money across states or actually just selling a house, the bank starts to ask questions. They might say, where's this money coming from? And you kind of have to explain, provide some paperwork about, where that money is originating from. And basically that's just part of the system that we've got going where banks and other entities have to report to AUSTRAC anything suspicious. So trade-based money laundering is a favourite one because there's lots of goods and services moving across states and countries all of the time. And because you've got the dirty money mixed in with actual movement of goods and services, it's very, very hard to sort of work out what the true value of these things are. So I suspect that's the press release talks about, changing the dates around the due-by dates of the meats. So basically when you can fudge the due-by dates to make bad meat look good and therefore kind of justify why there's high amounts of money related to that. So your listeners might be aware of the Netflix series Ozark, which is a great series that sort of goes into the sort of how organized crime tends to mix dirty money with cash intensive industries like hotels and bars.
What about with the food and agriculture industries? Is that something that you've seen before?
Not really. So most of the time it comes up on the radar around international stuff. So interstate's interesting. Generally, interstate, traditionally, when money's been needed to move, you kind of do it just by, transporting it across, in a car or a bike or something. So organized crime entities would be able to take care of that. So this is quite interesting because it hasn't really come up before. It makes sense in the sense that there's a lot of this kind of agricultural products moving between states all the time. But usually what's known in the literature is sort of, high value stuff like wine, that kind of thing. So sort of interstate using pork and that hasn't really come up on the radar before.
No, that's right. Professor Andreas Chai is at Griffith University talking about that pork meat being substituted, the $10 million of sales off the books, $30 million in cash, money laundering, fraud, destroying records, tainted property, relabeling frozen meat. So a whole bunch of stuff happening there that quite boggles the imagination. Getting some texts as well on the mulesing issue. Don from Dubbo says, we stopped mulesing in 2004. We didn't just stop mulesing. We bred the sheep so it wasn't necessary to mules. It took less than 5 years. There's a lot of genetics available, and it'd be quicker for growers now to stop mulesing. Wouldn't take them 5 years, he reckons. The result for them is no flies from stopping the mulesing and no chemical now required. But Tony at Armidale says wool producers absolutely do not want to stop mulesing. They don't want the hassle or the small added cost. And also getting some texts on the issue of the modern slavery commission and the call for some action on that from quite a range of people. We heard from James Cockayne earlier in the program. Steve says a lot of workers in the horticultural industry are being treated like slaves, as was shown in the recent Four Corners program here on the ABC. It's 12:30. It's time to get some news headlines now from Adam Storey. Good afternoon.
Afternoon, Michael. Excuse me, I'll just clear the throat, which I should have done 30 seconds before I went on air. How professional of me.
Oh, well, anyway. That's right. That's fine. You're forgiven.
A lot can happen in 30 seconds.
Exactly.
The Sydney Swans players are obviously refusing to comment about the sexual assault investigation that hit the club. The Swans players declined to comment, awaiting media as they arrived at club headquarters this morning. However, the Swans coach Dean Cox said the club was working with police and the AFL and would provide an update later on today. The search continues for 18-year-old Lily Hooper in the Natai National Park. It's now in its eighth day. Helicopters are flying above the Bonham Pick Trail where she went missing last Wednesday. Dozens of emergency service vehicles are stationed at the trail's car park with specialist police, ambulance and other crews taking turns to work through what they say are very deep ravines and creeks and cliff tops. Off to Canberra, and new restrictions on gambling advertising are expected to pass Parliament this week, with the government striking a tentative deal with the coalition that includes inducements for vulnerable and high-spending gamblers. Meanwhile, One Nation is pushing to cut the federal tobacco excise by 75% and freeze the indexation for 3 years in what it says is a bid to curb organised crime. This is a story that we keep hearing about, with estimates 80% of cigarettes and other nicotine products consumed in Australia last year were illegal because they are obviously significantly cheaper. Meanwhile, the federal opposition is threatening to hold up the government's reforms to the National Disability Insurance Scheme in the Senate unless Labor scraps the so-called widow's tax. The tax emerged as an issue after the May budget, and it means someone inherits an investment property from their spouse after they die could face a less generous tax treatment. Labor has promised to deal with the issue, but the coalition says it won't support the NDIS reforms unless that issue is dealt with immediately.
Right. Okay. Well, there you go. They have said they're going to deal with it, but the opposition say they want it dealt with now.
Yeah, right. First things first.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Thanks for that, Adam, and you'll be back at 1 o'clock.
That's what they say.
That's what they tell you to do.
That's the rumour on the streets.
Okay. Yep. Thanks, Adam.
Okay.
It's coming up to 27 minutes to one here on the Country Hour. Time to get some weather details. Afreen Hussain's at the Bureau. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Michael.
So still some rain on the coast, not much rain in the inland, but there's a front moving from the west, is that right?
Yeah, so it's a trough that is currently developing, and that brings some showers and storms to the western parts today, and that will extend into the southern inland tomorrow. So not looking at too much in terms of rainfall totals. We've seen about a millimetre or two in the gauges since 9 a.m. this morning, but looking at a further 5 to 10 millimetres over the course of today. And tomorrow as well, looking at similar totals as that system moves across.
Right, so that started to move across from the west now?
Yeah, so it's just developing in the west. It started late yesterday, the showers and storms, and they've just been continuing through the day. So we'll likely see that continuing through today and then tomorrow extending into the southern inland parts.
So we are seeing around that sort of 1 to 5 millimetres or maybe 5 to 10 millimetres in a few spots already?
So we've seen around 1 to 2 millimetres right. already since 9 a.m. this morning, yeah.
Okay, as it's just sort of started to move through. But it's expected it might be between 5 and 10. It will just depend on, because we're talking showers, it'll depend?
Yeah, that's right. So not looking at too much rainfall from this system, about 5 to 10 millimetres in the current forecast.
And how long will it last, the system?
Yeah, so that system moving into the southern inland tomorrow, and then Thursday we're looking at some further falls in the west and southern inland parts again. And then before we see a weak cold front come in that will sweep it up across the state, so seeing those showers contract to the northern half of the state on Friday and then further to the northeast by Saturday.
Right, okay. And then once the system's all gone through and it's sort of between 5 and 10 millimetres over, it sounds like a fairly large stretch of the state, so fairly helpful for those that are in the cropping regions. What's likely to happen then?
Yeah, so most places across the state likely to see a shower or two, but towards the weekend we'll see mostly dry conditions extend over much of the state as that system contracts to the southeast and Sunday as well.
Okay, so the southeast will get some of this rain because they've been missing out.
Yeah, that's right, but unfortunately we're not looking at any significant totals, but maybe just a shower or two there.
So maybe a bit less there.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, they wouldn't mind having sort of 10 to 20 or 30 millimetres there in the Monero and other parts, I would imagine, around Bega that's been very dry, but they're not likely to get that much.
Yeah, that's right. Unfortunately, not with this system. Not looking at too much rainfall associated with that.
And when once the system moves through, is the high going to sit there for a while, do you think?
Yeah, so from the weekend into next week, we start to see a weak high ridge develop across much of the state as that system contracts to the northeast. And then into next week, we're likely to see a series of cross and cold fronts move through. But in terms of further shower activity in the inland, they'll kind of depend on how things track through the week. So a bit of uncertainty at this lead time.
Okay, so at the moment we're talking showers, so that doesn't sound like a whole lot of rain.
Yeah, that's right. Not anything indicated in the current forecast.
In the current forecast, but I suppose yeah. that could change. Afreen, thanks for that.
No worries. Thanks, Michael.
It's 24 minutes to one here on the New South Wales Country Hour. Well, let's turn our attention to water news now, getting a few more texts about modern slavery. I'll get to them in a moment because the Condobolin region farmer Christopher Chalker has been convicted of pumping water from a creek when the meter wasn't working, breaching licence conditions and also not providing the required information. The farmer pleaded guilty to four charges in Forbes local court. The farmer was fined $8,500 and ordered to pay the Natural Resource Access Regulator legal costs, NRAS legal costs, bringing the total payout to $28,500. He was also placed on a conditional release order for 9 months and must publish a notice of his offending in the newspaper. The offences took place between April 2022 and March of 2024. Tim O'Connell is Director of Investigations Enforcement at NRAS and says it's been a long-running dispute.
That's right, Michael. This investigation came to our attention in January 2024, so it's just come to resolution through the local court system just last week. The investigation itself was complex, took time to fully investigate the matter and then obviously resolve itself through the court system.
And what was the outcome?
The outcome was four criminal convictions against this farmer who's from Condobolin. The allegations that were proven in the court were related to unlawful water take. So there was one count of taking water when a metering equipment was not working. There was two counts that were proven through the court when water orders were not placed and water was taken. And then the final count where an NRA investigation notice was not replied to. Ultimately, all four of those charges received criminal convictions. The offender was charged and ordered to pay NRA's legal costs of $28,500, as well as a fine. They need to publish their offending in a local newspaper, as well as they've been placed on a 9-month conditional release order from the court.
What does that mean?
That's a low-level alternative to a custodial sentence, if you like, as well as being community-based sentencing. So it replaces what was formerly known as the good behaviour bonds.
Because it's a criminal issue, they could have actually been incarcerated.
That's certainly a possibility under New South Wales water laws. The court obviously took into account the full nature of the offending and decided to impose the sentencing it did, of which NRA is really satisfied with the outcome.
So Condobolin taking water from the lock straight out of the Lachlan River, is that right?
off a tributary of the Lachlan, so it's really critical that in this circumstance it's a regulated catchment. The upstream dam, the Wyangula Dam, needs to have water orders placed before water is taken. That's a condition of this person's water access licence, and most water users in the stretch would have the same conditions. It's really critical that water is ordered. You wait for that order to be confirmed by Water New South Wales, and then you can take that once that order's been confirmed.
What sort of crops was he growing?
The crops were lucerne and winter cereal crops, and it principally it was an operation for fattening for lambs to go to market.
And can we name the farmer?
We can. Mr. Christopher Chalker, located in the Condobolin region, prosecuted through the local court. Our standard process is certainly to name offenders once they're convicted through the court system. One of the really critical charges that uphold our non-urban metering reforms is the taking of water when metering equipment's not working. Really critical for water users to understand that in the circumstances where metering equipment breaks down, they need to lodge what's called a 91i exemption with Water New South Wales, wait for that approval, and that enables them to take water while they go and get that meter equipment repaired within 21 days.
So this is sort of like a precedent for other cases elsewhere in the state.
Absolutely. So as we work towards higher levels of compliance with metering across New South Wales, we expect that water users will be following the rules with respect of meters are faulty or need replacement, they go through the correct procedures. And those procedures are really readily available through Water New South Wales' webpage.
Tim O'Connell is Director of Investigations Enforcement at NRAR, and talking about that long-running dispute with the Condobolin farmer who was convicted of pumping water from a creek when the meter wasn't working, breaching licence conditions and not providing required information. It's coming up to 18 minutes to one.
The New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Greg from Cooma says, why wasn't his licence cancelled? He's proven he isn't trustworthy enough to hold a licence, and Greg from Cooma thinks that is a tiny fine. It's coming up, as I said, it's coming up to 18 minutes to one here on the New South Wales Country Hour. Let's turn our attention to bird flu now, because after consultation with local exhibitors and government departments about the potential risks of H5 bird flu, the committee in Finlay has decided to cancel the poultry exhibits for this year. The zone final, the poultry junior judging competition, was due to be held at the show, and it's also been postponed as well. Stuart Stephen Legg told Emily Doak, although bird flu hasn't been detected locally, the committee is taking a cautious approach.
Let's say an exhibitor bringing a bird along to a show where a wild bird may have flown over or visited their backyard and deposited fecal matter in their yard or come into contact with exhibition birds in their chook yard, and we don't want that anomaly to happen at a show and therefore put at risk other breeders, exhibitors, birds in the Riverina region and indeed the greater region of the country.
And what about the young judges who were due to compete in a zone final, I understand? I'd imagine there's a bit of disappointment there. Will there be opportunity for them to compete in that poultry judging at another time?
Yeah, look, absolutely, and I feel for them greatly. However, nobody knows, it's still in the lap of the gods, as to how long the hiatus or cancellation of poultry sections at small agricultural shows or indeed major agricultural shows will take. If we look at overseas examples, let's say in Great Britain and Europe and America, their exhibitions went into a hiatus for a minimum of 2 years and a maximum of up to four, nearly 5 years.
And the particular breeds that these breeders have in our region, I'd imagine some of them are, you know, interesting, rare, and probably pretty valuable because of that genetically?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And that entails us going with a great security and cautionary approach in cancelling the poultry exhibition at Finlay because of the rarity of a gene pool. There's nowhere else to go to try and get a start again with some of these breeds. The price of the bird itself may go into $1,500, $2,000 for a top-class exhibition fowl that has won numerous prizes and has a bloodline of breeding consistent winners. Now, when you multiply that by 50 or 60 birds that a fancy breeder or exhibitor may have in their backyard, that adds up to quite a few dollar signs, and just the absolute gut-wrenching horror and disbelief if the avian influenza wiped that out would just be horrific.
And obviously for people who are involved in this, it's going to have a big impact on their lifestyle as well, because I'd imagine they take great joy out of being able to breed and show these birds. Is there any way that you think that it could continue by harnessing technology? Could we show birds via Zoom or FaceTime or any of sort of technology being used to sort of keep these traditions and this practice going on during this time, do you think?
Look, it well could. I have known online shows to take place overseas, and there's been a few that have come up online in Australia. However, when you're judging poultry for a competition, one of the greatest assets in determining the quality of a fowl is handling the bird, opening the bird's wings to see what their flight feathers are like colour-wise, condition-wise, health-wise, and nearly 50 to 60% is all handling of the fowl.
That's Finlay Show Society poultry steward Stephen Legg speaking there with Emily Doak about the decision to not have birds at the show on the 6th of September. So making the decision to cancel the poultry exhibits at the annual Finlay Show in September. Normally they would have had about 150 birds. It's coming up to 13 minutes to one.
You're listening to The Country Hour
on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Hello, I'm Andy Park. Joining me for The World Today is Donald Trump threatens to bomb US ally Oman as Iran vows to escalate the conflict over the Strait of Hormuz. Sydney Swans coach Dean Cox says he's disappointed over an incident at a Melbourne hotel which has sparked a police investigation. The fallout across the aged care sector continues with more than 53,000 people taken off the official aged care waiting list. And who killed Tupac Shakur? His murder trial opens 30 years after the rapper's death. Join me for The World Today.
But here on The Country Hour, the prestigious Tim Fisher Fellowship is open once more and is designed to support individuals passionate about making a difference in rural and regional Australia through the power of education. Inspired by Tim Fisher's honesty, integrity and selflessness, this fellowship supports a recipient with up to $50,000 in funding, mentorships and networking opportunities to help turn their bold ideas into reality. The proposed project must include an education element. Wendy Mason, CEO of the Country Education Foundation, and is urging anyone over the age of 18 with a vision for rural Australia with an educational aspect to it to apply.
Yeah, the Country Education Foundation is really delighted that we're offering the Tim Fisher Fellowship again this year after its inaugural year last year. So we're building on that success. And it's designed to support individuals passionate about making a difference in rural and regional Australia through the power of education.
And it's good for one person, but I guess there'd be a lot of people out there, deserving people out there, that could get a fellowship.
Look, absolutely. We're looking for people who have got a practical idea that addresses a real challenge in country communities. So they could be from agriculture, health, education, science, technology, the arts, any sector, really. But the fellowship delivers $50,000, some mentoring, networking opportunity to really help that Australian turn their bold idea into reality. with an education element to really make sure that they're driving for real outcomes for rural and regional communities. And when we say education, we mean that really broadly. That education component or element can be delivered through communities, workplaces, with youth or students or through other educational contexts. It's not just automatically school or university.
And what's the background to this? Was it something that Tim Fisher was passionate about individually or his family?
Yeah, well, look, the fellowship continues the legacy of Tim Fisher, who, as many of your listeners would know, he really believed in education. He believed in the power of rural and regional communities, and he believed that opportunities could really transform our communities. So it's not for want of talent or ideas. It's just about really providing the opportunity. So Tim was our inaugural patron. He really believed Country Education Foundation was really driving towards the power of education to change individuals' lives, but also their families and communities. And so this fellowship, named in his honour, really honours that legacy that he's left, but really also understands that an individual can really, with the right backing, make change in their communities and really drive outcomes for rural and regional communities. So it's about finding a good idea. Tim had plenty of them, and an individual who's ready to drive towards some action. So we're really looking for someone who can honour that legacy, I suppose. So the judging process will be rigorous but also quite difficult. We have a number of finalists last year, and so we will be again looking at a similar process of applying a judging matrix with an expert panel, and then those finalists will be coming to Sydney for interviews that they're happening on the 8th of October with the announcement in Sydney on the 9th. Applications are open for another week, so people really need to get their skates on. It's really not that difficult, though. I'd encourage people to go to our website, Country Education Foundation's website, cef.org.au, to find out some more information, to find the program guidelines, and to understand that applications are closing at 5 p.m. on exactly in a week's time, the 24th of August.
Right, and I guess the other thing is it doesn't have to be, you don't have to be an educator, you don't have to be involved at university, you can be involved in medicine or, you know, in farming, a whole range of things to be eligible for a fellowship.
Really important criteria, that one. So it's really about applying an education element, and when we talk about that, it is about, I suppose, it could be something. It should be. It could be a training component. It could be through a workplace. It could be the bringing the community together in some way to ensure that the impact of this fellowship is beyond that one individual. So it's really about the impact being created through an education element, but as you say, open to people across communities and across sectors. The criteria is you do need to be an Australian resident and over 18. You need to be passionate about supporting rural and regional communities, be willing to represent Country Education Foundation as an ambassador, and I think critically really have a strong vision and commitment to your area of study or the project needs to kind of have some really pragmatic approach. You've got over a year, you've got $50,000, you've got some networking and mentorship, but what bold idea could you turn into reality with this fellowship's backing?
Wendy Mason is the CEO of the Country Education Foundation. Applications for the Tim Fisher Fellowship have to be entered in by the 24th of August, which is next Monday. Let's go to markets. First up, let's go to Wodonga Cattle.
Good afternoon. A little bit of sunshine helped lift numbers to 968. The usual buyers made it to the sale and all competed over a fair to very good quality yarding. Cow numbers declined to 357, which created strong bidding on all style of cow. There was a small but very good selection of veal with prices unchanged. The better veal sold from 452 to 545. Trade steers were back 5 cents, 485 to 532. Feeder steers, medium weight, too few to quote, 466 to 524. Million weight feeder heifers, however, gained 40 cents on account of quality, 468 to 502. Trade heifers improved 10, 440 to 475. Heavy steers and bullocks, 410 to 530. Heavy heifers sold 5 cents better, 410 to 488. Heavy cows, there was no change, 390 to 432. Leaner cows, under 530 kilo, very few, 344 to 381. Bulls, the heavy end, 422 to 440. I'm Leanne Ducks, MLA.
Let's go to Forbes Sheep and Lambs.
Good afternoon. Numbers increased this sale with agents yarding 41,300 head. Lamb numbers increased to 32,400 and quality continues to be similar to that of previous sales. There was good numbers of well-finished trade and export lambs available, along with the planar and secondary types. The usual buyers are present competing in a fluctuating but mostly cheaper market. There was 4,600 new season lambs penned and these sold from $260 to $308 a head. Heavyweight lambs are $4 to $8 easier, with trade weight lambs 20 to 24 kilos selling from $252 to $302 a head. Heavy lambs 24 to 26 kilos sold from $290 to $320, while the export lambs ranged in price from $318 to a top of $413 a head. Carcass prices averaged from $1,075 to $1,211 a kilo. The best heavy hogget reached $322 a head. The balance of the lambs and 8,900 head of mutton are still to be sold. This has been Crystal Ridley at Forbes.
Let's go to Carcor Cattle.
Good afternoon. Numbers increased by 700 for 1,780 mixed quality cattle. There were more cattle in better condition, but there was also a much plainer tail. The feeders were well supplied and there was a good selection of trade cattle. Grown steers and bullocks remained limited and around 350 cows were penned. The market sold to a cheaper trend with only the heavy feeders dearer. Weaner steers slipped 10 cents and reached $5.95. The heifers were back 5, topping at $5.05. Medium weight feeders were 11 cents softer, 486 to 577, but the heavy feeder steers were 10 to 15 better, 500 to 573. Medium weight feeder heifers lost 20 cents, 451 to 525. Heavyweights were firm and reached 530. Most of the trade cattle ranged between 460 and 480. The prime grown steers lost 3 cents, 430 to 460. Heavy grown heifers firmed to 5 cents softer, 430 to 455. The cows lost 3 to 5 cents with heavyweights 375 to 412. The leaner two scores 320 to 381.
Let's go to Gunnedah now.
1,900 cattle were yarded in Gunnedah this week, an increase of nearly 400 on last week. It was good quality yarding of predominantly weaner and yearling cattle with some good lines of feeder cattle on offer. All major buyers were present for a market that saw light restock of cattle and feeder heifers increase in value, while most other grades were cheaper. Young cattle to the trade made from 430 to 465 cents a kilogram. Yearling steers to feed were 20 cents cheaper to make from 450 to 589 cents. Yearling heifers to feed were 15 cents dearer and more in places to make from 460 to 540 cents a kilogram. Light cattle to the restocker were considerably dearer. The steers made from 470 to 580 cents, while the heifers made from 412 to 530 cents a kilogram. Prime grown cattle to the processor made from 404 to 449 cents. Cows were 5 to 8 cents cheaper and more in places. Two score cows made from 298 to 318 cents. Three score cows made from 360 to 380 cents a kilogram. Four score prime heavyweight cows made from 384 to 395 cents. And the best of the bulls got to 375 cents a kilo. This is Hamish Hosegood in Gunnedah for MLA.
Let's go to Inverell Cattle now.
Good afternoon. Agents Inverell penned 1,300 cattle up by 833 head. All the regular export and feeder buyers attended and responded to the lift in numbers and the quality offered, which resulted in prices lifting across the yearling feeder and restocker lines. The penning of heavy cows sold a firm to slightly dearer trends. Yearling steers in the 280 range to restocker sold from 374 to 610. Yearling steers over 280 sold from 420 to 594. And medium weight yearling steers to feed sold from 470 to 554. Heavy yearling steers to feed sold at 404 to 516, with those to the wholesale meat trade at 420. Yearling heifers in the 200 to 330 range to background sold from 390 to 476. Medium weight yearling heifers to feed sold from 368 to 520, with the heavy yearling heifers to feed at 464 to 546. Grown heifers to processor sold from 368 to 530. Lightweight plain condition cows to restockers sold from 262 to 370, with those to processors at 278 to 330. Heavy score 3 cows to processors sold from 338 to 355. Good heavy cows to processors sold from 364 to 391. And heavy bulls topped at 400. This has been AeroLuck, MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Let's get a scone cattle now.
Good afternoon.
Quality of the weaner calves remained high as similar numbers were put together by Scone agents to yard 453 cattle. Following on from last week, light steer calves sold dearer rates of 20 to 40 cents a kilo, making between 450 and 588 cents to average around 554. Following in their footsteps, light heifer calves are up to 45 cents a kilo dearer, selling from 385 to 556 and average just over 500 cents. Prime B-muscle butcher calves weighing 365 kilos made up to 538. Only a handful of yearlings presented, with feeder steers selling in a range of 404 to 500 and heifers to feed on 470 to 498, whilst prime processing types topped at 538. Grown steers and heifers to process sold from 400 to 456. 100 cows were penned, all selling to cheaper rates. Lighter two scores 180 to 330. Heavy 3 and 4 scores slipped 2, selling between 360 and 395, whilst the best heavy bull topped at 400. Angus Barlow for MLA at Scone.
You've been listening to the New South Wales Country Hour. We're heading up to news time at 1 o'clock.